Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2023, October 6. Our topic today is the solar eclipse of 2023, October 14, and yes, IB John Pasmino. I'm releasing this session early on about September 26, because many of our readers are making plans to view this eclipse, and they asked if they could somehow get early information about it to help plan their trips. So I was going to use a different topic for October 6th, but I put together this session about the eclipse and then also issue it about 3 weeks early. So make sure you have the both files, audio and video. If you are missing the video files, which has the slideshow, then this presentation alone will be nonsense. Go to www.nyskies.org, and on the home page near the top, click on audio video files. On the AV files page, you can skip the text for the time being. Scroll down to the bottom where you have the links to our seminars. You're looking for, near the bottom, solar eclipse of 2023, October 6th. And you'll see the links for the PPT, Papa Papa Tango file. That's the slideshow. And if you happen to know a friend who missed the audio, do me a favor and download the MP3, My Papa Number 3 file. That's the narration you're listening to now. All right, so you're all fired up and you're standing on slide 1. And this is the quiz I left you with last time. I asked, how did the word satellite, as you say in English, ever come to mean moon, to the point where moon and satellite are essentially interchangeable? In fact, in some glossaries, we see the word satellite and it's defined to mean a moon, or a small body orbiting a larger one. And then under the letter M, we see moon, and the definition is a satellite, or a small body orbiting a large one. The slide 1 is a page from an online Latin dictionary, and at the top we see two words, satellus and satellites. I'm using the continental, which is close enough to Latin pronunciation, and it gives some yada yada about the word. It's a third declension word, which tells the user how to modify the spelling according to its use in a sentence. That is, the declension tells you the grammatical modifications of the word, they'll say the gender is common in the sense that the word can be used to describe a masculine or a feminine or a neuter concept. And then you have definitions, and if you look under them, you get the reason Galileo picked this word. It's a companion, aid, an accompaniment, a bodyguard, whatever. Because when he saw Jupiter, which represented the king of the gods, well, any noble person, any important person, will have with him, you know, a bunch of companions, attendants, sidekicks. Those of us in New York, in the last week or so, know this in spades because the United Nations General Assembly opened its session, and the heads of states from about, I think, 155 of the member countries came to New York. And as they went here and there, to and from their hotel, to and from the UN, to and from entertainments, they went with a retinue or a team, a crew of attendants, usually a small motorcade. So on any given day, you could have a few dozen of these cruising around Manhattan, meaning that the streets had to be closed to let them have a free and open passage. And so for about a kilometer radius around the United Nations headquarters, we were in pretty much a frozen zone. So that probably prompted the spurt of responses I got over this past weekend, the 22nd, 23rd, 24th, and yesterday, 25th. So I said, hey, now I know what was Galileo was on to. So the word satellite, again the English pronunciation, originally referred to attendants or orderlies or servants of the king Jupiter, represented by the little stars that circulated around the planet Jupiter. The next planet to have a moon discovered was Saturn, discovered by Huygens, and he, also speaking Latin, this is the 17th century, took up Galileo's idea where Saturn has one companion. Well, he, as a god, wasn't anywhere as important as Jupiter, so Saturn didn't earn that many companions. And since then, the term simply got assumed into the astronomy literature. Now, we do use it in geopolitics, where certain small countries are under political or economic control of a larger one, like the Soviet Union had a bunch of countries in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, and they were often called satellite countries. So that's the story of how a simple, ordinary word came to have an astronomical meaning and then came back as an ordinary word in non-astronomy use. So, let's move on to slide 2. 2 is the title page summarize the AV files page in the inverse sense. That is, your friend may have the video slideshow, and when he plays the slides, he has no idea what's going on, so this tells him, go to our website and get the narration file. And then under that are links to supplemental reading. One is called ECL-FACT, meaning Eclipse Fact. And that is the boilerplate which was accumulated in my early years of promoting solar or lunar eclipses. Instead of repeating that stuff each time an eclipse came along, I gathered that all into a permanent file in a web which is linked to here, so that when I now announce lunar eclipses, I substantially just give the information for the specific eclipse. And if you want the theory and mechanics and maths, go to that file. The second one, which is number one, MIN-ECL, 1 minute eclipse, which is my observations of the solar eclipse back in 2021. And the 1 minute refers to the space between clouds through which I saw this eclipse. Just 1 minute gap before clouds came back and covered up the sun. In three, we have a general map of the world showing solar eclipses in the 2020s decade, taken from the eclipse section of NASA's website. The red arcs are the paths for annular eclipses, and we'll discuss what that is, and the blue are total eclipses. If you go to the upper left part of the picture, you see the United States. I hope you know your geography. And there are three eclipses. One just misses the United States. It starts north of the Great Lakes and goes up north toward the North Pole and is labeled 2021. And it's red. That was an annular eclipse. There was a partial eclipse in New York, and that's the one that I saw in that 1 minute eclipse file. On the left side of the United States, that is from the West Coast down into the Gulf of Mexico, labeled 2023, is the eclipse for this session, the one on October 14th. And it, too, is an annular eclipse. The thinner blue arc coming out of Mexico past the Great Lakes and into the St. Lawrence area is a total eclipse in 2024, and it's on April 8th. We'll have a special session for that as well. The thickness of the band is the diameter of the shadow of the moon on the ground. So the one in 2023 has a broad path, meaning that the central phase, when the moon is on the sun, will have a longer duration, whereas the 2024 eclipse is narrow, which would suppose that the eclipse would be of a short central phase duration. But you see, in the decade of the 1920s, there are about maybe 30 eclipses all over the world. Now, some of them are in places you don't even want to go near, like the South Pole or Iran or over there in Eastern Russia and Korea. And others are over normal vacation or touristy districts in Europe, parts of South America, Australia. And there are eclipse trips, commercial excursions to visit these eclipses. And they can be a dedicated trip for the eclipse, or it could be a one of the normal tourist trips which happens to take place during the eclipse. So they'll swap out one sightseeing feature for a stop on the side of a road or atop of your hotel to view the eclipse. So keep your eye on the astronomy literature, both printed and web-based, for advertisements about these trips. And you should choose among them as carefully as you would for any other vacation or tourist travel. The extra gotcha is weather, which you cannot predict, although some eclipse advertisers tell you that they will guarantee you see the eclipse. Well, it better not be a guarantee in the American legal sense, but nevertheless, you know, use your street smarts when evaluating these trips. A close-up of the United States in picture 4 gives a little more detail for the two eclipses I mentioned. And there's also a third one on this plot, which runs from the northwest of the United States into the Atlantic seacoast over South Carolina. That's the Great American Eclipse of 2017. An awful lot of my readers, of course, this is back in the in-person days of New York Sky at the meeting, went down to South Carolina or Kentucky or Wyoming to view it, while others were content with the partial eclipse we saw here in New York. So that's the path. Note carefully that the 2023 eclipse and the 2024 eclipse cross in southern Texas in and around San Antonio, which is a very popular tourist place to visit. I've heard already, with the general migration of people from the northern states into Texas and also Florida and a couple of others, that they'll go to San Antonio as a possible relocation site, view the eclipse, explore around, maybe even acquire a new home, and then stay there for the 2024 eclipse. So they got the bonus of relocating from a undesirable state to one which is more welcoming. They get to see two solar eclipses in about a 6-month span. The next couple of slides review, not a very detailed explanation, why we have solar and lunar eclipses and why they can't occur every month. From your high school physics, and certainly from your astronomy, you know that a solar eclipse can occur only at new moon. The moon passes in front of the sun on the day when it is new in phase. And you can have a lunar eclipse only when the moon passes through the shadow of the Earth, which can only occur when the moon is in full phase. But it gets a little loose what happens in between. So this diagram in picture 5 shows 4 stages in the Earth's motion around the sun, with the moon going around the Earth. And the first thing we notice is that the orbit of the moon is inclined, tilted, relative to the Earth orbit. Earth orbit is the blue background field, or blue-gray, and then the gray is the moon's orbit. You may want to follow this a bit if you have a hard-covered book, not a paperback, a hardcover book. And if you open it and you hold the cover at an angle relative to the book on the table, the gutter between the cover and the spine is the intercept between the moon's orbit, that's the cover, and the plane of the Earth's orbit, that's the book and table. The line that is the gutter, the intercept, is the line of nodes. So we'll start at the upper right picture. We have that the tilt is such that when you have a new moon, the shadow of the moon misses the Earth, and you have a full moon, the shadow of the Earth misses the moon. So we would get normal new moons and normal full moons. To the upper left, 3 months later, because you're counterclockwise rotation in this diagram, the line of nodes happens to line up with the sun. So the sun also is in line with the Earth and the moon. So a new moon there could pass in front of the sun and throw her shadow onto the Earth for a solar eclipse. A full moon could dip into the shadow of the Earth for a lunar eclipse. And in fact, the Earth's motion around the sun is slow enough that the rapid movement of the moon around the Earth could cause a pair of eclipses, sun and moon, and occasionally 2 moon eclipses with the sun one in between. Okay, the lower left, we're going around another 3 months, and again, the line of nodes is off the line to the sun, and the shadow of the Earth will miss the moon, and the shadow of the moon will miss the Earth. Then we go to the lower right, where we again get the lineup. This is at the opposite end of the line of nodes, and the shadow of the moon can hit the Earth, or the shadow of the Earth can hit the moon. And we get a second season, if you will, of a couple of eclipses. Now, the diagram here shows them as occurring 6 months apart. But let's go back to your book. Hold the cover at an angle, but rotate the book on the table. The line of nodes will then point to different places around the room, which might be the zodiac. Hence, and also, the rotation is, in this diagram, would be clockwise upstream through the zodiac. The moon and the sun course through the zodiac downstream, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, etc. But the line of nodes for the lunar orbit regress Gemini, Taurus, Aries, Pisces, and so on. The complete circuit is about 18 years. What happens then is, say the upper left picture, we got eclipses. If we wait one full year, the line of nodes has rotated a bit so that the lineup will occur a little earlier than 6 months, or roughly 5.5 months, or 5 months and 10 days, thereabouts. So that the seasons of eclipses are spaced about 5.5 months apart, and you typically would get two in each year. A very dramatic view of this is in Figure 6. Oh, this is delightful. Those of us who chase eclipses or otherwise follow news about them have a picture like this on their refrigerator, picture like this next to their computer, folded picture in the glove box in their car, one in their observatory, one in their telescope tool kit, and maybe even one, a smaller one, in their wallet. So no matter where they are, they can look at that chart and tell when upcoming eclipses are expected. So the years are down the side. The last year is 2025. I'm hoping by then someone will extend this for another 10 or so more years. But and even then, there's enough years here to bring out the pattern. Across the bottom are dates, or the divide by months. So if you take, say, 2023, which is where we are now, I think it's the third one from the bottom, and in January, February, March, we have no eclipses because the sun does not line up with the nodal line of the Earth-Moon. We're getting normal full moons and new moons. But then in April, we have a couple of eclipses. The symbol for the moon notes a lunar eclipse, and the round dot represents solar eclipse. Now some of them are shaded partially or completely, and I'll skip that for the time being, just that you get a lunar eclipse and a total solar eclipse. And we continue across on 2023, and we get the next season in October, September, October, in between, during the summer months, no eclipses, just regular full moons and new moons, and then we get eclipses again, this time. Well, you can see that the picture for the sun has a ring around it, which indicates that this is an annular eclipse. And then we move farther to the right into the winter. Again, no eclipses. But next year, 2024, you go across and see that we get eclipses in April earlier than those of the previous year. And continue across in 2024, we have eclipses September, October, again, a weekish or more earlier than in 2023. So in the course of the years, the seasons come earlier and earlier on the calendar. And you get this wonderful diagonal drift of eclipses over this roughly 20-year period. What the hell is an annular eclipse? That's A Unnular, coming from the word annulus, meaning a ring or a hoop or a circle, as distinct from a total eclipse. T-tangle, oh, how you have, yes, you can spell total. All right, so the upper picture in slide 7 shows the shadow of the moon hitting the earth, and the shadow, which is a cone shape, that's why it nets down to about 100 to 200 kilometers diameter on the earth, as against the 3,500 or so kilometers for the diameter of the moon. So you get a spot on the earth which is shaded from direct sunlight, and we get the scene looking at the sun on the upper right. We have the black disk of the moon, and we have a pearly white glow, which actually is the solar atmosphere or corona. The inner corona is shown here, but the corona in the sky during the eclipse could actually extend several diameters of the moon, angular diameters. So it could extend from where the sun is in that picture all the way out to the left margin in some cases. Usually it'll extend out to where the picture of the earth is. In that eclipse, the ground is darkened to, say, mid-twilight. A few of the brightest stars and the whatever planets are out there are visible. And if there's any wildlife around, they go cuckoo because nighttime is coming at the wrong expected hour according to their internal clock. And a lot of other things. The wind picks up and blows all around you, or you make it very, very chilly because the sunlight is blocked. And a whole bunch of other things. So a solar eclipse in a total phase is an experience which you folks, if you hadn't done so already, you must do so before you leave this world. It's like visiting Rome or Jerusalem or the Dalai Lama or that kind of thing. The lower picture, we have that the moon is a little farther from the earth. Remember, the moon's orbit be elliptical, meaning it is an elliptic. So at some point, it's going to be farthest at apogee and closest at perigee. So at apogee, or around that area in the orbit, the shadow does not reach the earth. And so what happens is, you have the cone coming through a point, and then you have an anti-umbra, which then starts to flare out. But within that zone, and on the ground where it hits, the moon is too small angularly to cover the sun completely. So when the sun is behind the moon, the rim of the sun peaks around the edge of the moon. That's the lower right picture. And this was taken, obviously, either it's a simulated view, or if it be an actual photograph, taken through dense solar filters. The eclipse in October is of this sort, annular. And because the sun is always visible, never completely occluded, you must have full solar protection for direct viewing, or you must use indirect methods such as projection. So just to remember that there'll be no moment when you can remove your solar filter or your viewing glasses and look straight at the sun. By the way, I did witness one of the very, very shortest eclipses of the annular type in South Carolina, back in the 20th century, and that literally lasted about 5 seconds. That is, soon as the moon fully covered the sun, or got onto the sun, and I turned to my lady buddy to ask if she was seeing this, which she was. She was using her scope. Then I went back to look through my scope, and the moon was already moving off. But during that interval, when my head was turned toward her, I just figured, let me glance at the sun and see what's going on. And that effing sun was still way too bright to look at steadily. I had to turn away. It dazzled me. So please, you come with only one set of eyes, and being a low vision person myself, I can attest to how valuable that pair is. So that is what an annular eclipse is. The distinction between annular and total is shown more clearly in figure 8. This was taken by some fellow who collected the pictures from the same eclipse of the sun back in 2013, and he cut them in half and put them together to the same scale. What happened here is, remember, the Earth is round, so a person standing on the edge of the Earth, as seen from the moon, could be too far away for the shadow to reach the ground, and the folk there, which would be near the local sunrise or sunset, would see the annular eclipse. But those in the midday part of the world, which is bulging closer to the sun and the moon, the shadow can reach the ground and we get a total eclipse. So the eclipse transitions from annular when it begins to total in the middle of the day, back to annular when it ends. That's also called a hybrid eclipse, which happened in November 2013. I and others saw that here in the city as a partial eclipse. But the left-hand side is from the total phase in the midday, and you see the inner corona, and notice that the moon is noticeably a little bigger than the sun. On the right side is a picture taken from the end of the eclipse. I don't remember, the sunrise or sunset, one of his associates sent him a picture, and the sun is a wee bit bigger, or the moon being a wee bit smaller than the sun, and we have the ring effect around the sun. I chose this because from the same eclipse, so that the solar angular diameter remained constant. The Earth's orbit is elliptical also, but it's the difference in the lunar distance based on the location of the observer on the Earth. So that is the distinction between the two kinds of eclipse, and a hybrid annular total, it can happen within the same eclipse. A crossover point, or a critical point, is in picture 9. It shows the moon virtually exactly the same size as the sun. Now, remember, the sun is essentially a perfect sphere. I know we've tried on various eclipses in the 20th century to tell if the moon or the sun was, you know, oblate or otherwise out of round. And so far we found it's perfectly round. The moon, on the other hand, has a rough topography with mountains and valleys. So even though in angular size, in this picture, is the same as the sun, there'd be a valley between mountains which will let some sun shine through, and that's what we're seeing here, the inflection point between a total and an annular eclipse. In this situation, you could be looking up at the sun, and the shadow cone comes to a point about a meter off the ground. So the lice in your hair will see a total eclipse, and the fungus in your toes sees the annular eclipse, but the lint in your belly button will get the critical eclipse. Now, before the space age, when we could observe the Earth in space, the calculations of the eclipse and what it would look like relied a lot on imagination or mental gyrations and gymnastics, because we could plot the eclipse path on the ground. And by the way, there's a fabulous book, which you may want to look for in antique bookshops and stuff, called The Graphical Computation of Eclipses and also Occultations. I have that book. I got that when I was in school, and I leafed through it, and I actually did the computations for an eclipse. I forget the exact year, but probably 1972, which would be like the next chance I would have to see a total solar eclipse. In figure 10. Now that we have space views of the Earth, these are from three human crewed spacecraft. I forget which one, but we had many of them. We had Skylab, we had the Gemini missions, the Salyut, Mir, ISS, and the Chinese space stations. In the upper left corner, we have the actual spot at the end of the cone of the moon's shadow on the ground for a solar eclipse. And that thing skitters across the ground at a speed of around 1 kilometer per second. It's fast. That's why some eclipse trips, you'll hire the eclipse tour operator would charter a jet plane and would chase the shadow. Of course, the shadow outruns it, but you can dwell within it for maybe 5 or 10, 15 minutes. But this is a large area spot. I tried to scale the two upper pictures using the curvature of the Earth as a guide. So that is took a long time, many minutes, to cross a point down on the ground. That's a long duration total eclipse. The upper right, which appears to be over water, so it's probably a cruise ship down there, a small circle for the umbra, the center spot, because the moon is a little farther away, and so the intercept is at a narrower part of the shadow cone, and that whizzes across, the totality would be fairly short, maybe a minute or two. The lower picture is intriguing. They're very hard to come by because everyone fixates on total eclipses, and the scale is quite different. The curvature of the Earth is more shallow. I just had whatever picture came along. Notice the darker spot, and you can see structure on the surface, which is the top of clouds. So the guys on the ground missed this eclipse. But the illumination in that shadow comes from the ring of sun surrounding the moon in an annular eclipse. And an annular eclipse, the sky does not visually darken very much. It may take on a kind of dull, or some people say greasy, appearance, but I have not really had definite knowledge that stars were visible. Venus, if it's near the sun, will be seen, but that's about it. And you can walk around, you can see your equipment, read the dials, and work the mechanisms almost as if it were normal daylight. If you like the idea of fooling around with the size of the moon and also the sun to a lesser extent, then slide 11 is for you. This is for a club meeting or a class from the science school. You can snap this picture and print it on laser acetate, the plastic sheets that were used for making overhead projection pictures, or as they're called, sort of view graphs. Make sure when you buy these at a school supply store or office supply store that it is intended for use in computer printers, because if you just take a plastic sheet like for a report cover or a separated sheet between book chapters or something, it will melt in many printers, and you basically ruined your printer. So just make sure that it is suitable for computer printers. Okay, so you got to make a few prints and carefully cut the four pictures apart. And you give each set to a student or a member, or maybe a squad of them, and ask them to overlay them, moon on the sun, different combinations, and see what makes the maximum coverage, the greatest overlap of moon on sun, and what makes the loosest coverage, where there's the most sun shining around the edge of the moon. And it'll give you a better idea of the role that the sun or moon distance from the observer play. It's a lot of fun. Now, it can be difficult to visualize the distance of the Earth, Moon, and also the location of the line of nodes, because astronomy programs, for the most part, do not mark these in the sky along with the planets and the sun and the moon. So I just crank up my astrology program and cut a horoscope for the date of the solar eclipse. There be it over here in slide 12. So if you're expectant, and you can push a little harder and have your child be born on October 14th, that's his horoscope. I made it for noon, local noon in New York, but since the value of a horoscope is mumbo-jumbo anyway, what's a few hours among astronomers? Astrologers keep track of the north or ascending node of the moon, which is marked on here. I'll point it out. This program happens not to mark the descending node, but you can tell that because it's diametrically opposite in the sky. It also marks the apogee, farthest point in the lunar orbit, but not the perigee, which again is just 180 degrees away. All right, the inner ring is an angulator, which I rotated for this picture to zero in on the sun and moon, since the sun and moon are coincident. it gives elongation of any other parent in the zodiac, including the other planets, from the sun. If the elongation is counterclockwise, it's an east elongation, and objects in that zone would be in your evening and early night sky. Elongations clockwise are western elongation from the sun, and they would be in your post-midnight and morning sky. Astrologers do not care if the elongation is east or west. And in fact, I ask, well, when you have a sextile, which is a 60 degree elongation, doesn't matter if the Jupiter is 60 degrees east of the sun as against 60 degrees west of the sun. And the answer I get is no. Well, that's astrology for you. The next ring out is where the symbols for the planets are posted. The location of the symbol is not actually where it is in the zodiac. From each symbol is a line, a leader, that comes down to the elongation circle. So the leader from the sun and the leader from the moon both come to the zero mark on the elongation circle, meaning that they're both coincident, the same with all the other planets around the zodiac. By the way, the horizontal line with east at the left and west at the right, that's your horizon. The arc of the zodiac above that is in your sky, and the arc under is below the Earth, not visible. So you can see that Jupiter is not visible, and there's no visible thing for the ascending, no, but it's down there. Whereas Mars is in the sky, a little east of the sun, and Venus is a little bit west of the sun. So that's how you interpret. Then where the ecliptic would cross your local north-south meridian is where it says south near the top of the chart. MC is medium coelum, or coelum, which is the middle of the sky, or mid-heaven. This is where on the sky the ecliptic is crossing the meridian. If you can do the sidereal time in ecliptic longitude. that's what it is. And then it will correspond to a particular sidereal time of right ascension. Then the circle outside of that is the signs of the zodiac. And longitude on the ecliptic in astrology is somewhat the way we give dates within the year. We give the month and then the day number within that. We could have, as you do for Mars, just number the dates 0 through however many there are in a Martian year. So if you look at the little symbol for the sun, and you see a tiny number to the upper right, that's the degree within the sign it sits in, which is Libra. So it would be Libra 21. And you can convert that to astronomical ecliptic longitude by noting that the circuit starts at 0 at Aries, and by the time you got to Virgo, that's 180 degrees of longitude, and then 21 degrees more than that. So the longitude of the sun and the moon are about 191 degrees of longitude. None of the other planets are of special interest at the moment. But once in a while, certainly during the summer months, Jupiter and Saturn, if you get Jupiter, which is around 4:30 o'clock in the ring of planet symbols, it looks like a fancy number four, kind of. Okay, you have the degree within his sign, and then a tiny, might be a little hard to tell, it's a tiny lower right letter R for Romeo. That indicates that the planet for the date of the chart is in retrograde motion. A astronomy program typically will not tell you that. It will mark the place of a planet in the zodiac, and it's up to you externally to figure out if it's in prograde or retrograde movement. But the astrology program during the retrograde loop of a planet, like for Jupiter, it will actually put the little R to flag it. Again, it's a good extra little tidbit for you to know to plan your observing. Okay, besides the planets, the astrology programs will always show the apogee for the moon's orbit. A few will also show the perigee, but this one does not. And also the ascending or north node of the lunar orbit. Some will also show the descending node, but this one does not. It's a little curious to me that showing the apogee is, as far as I know, the only instance in astrology where the linear distance to the celestial object, the moon in this case, has some importance enough to mark the farthest point on the lunar orbit in the horoscope. For all the other planets, they're pasted onto the celestial sphere at some indefinite distance away. The apogee is a little bit to the right of the moon, and it looks like a Pac-Man sitting on a chair or a bench, and it has a little number next to it to show you its degree within its own sign. The opposite point, the perigee, is simply 180 degrees away, so you can simply pick the opposite elongation on the angle circle. The node, the ascending node is always shown, and a few will give you the descending node also, and that is the symbol that looks like a bicycle clip that for your pants cuff, and or the beret for putting in your hair, kind of looks like a capital Omega, and that's down there around the 5-ish o'clock position, and the descending node would be diametrically opposite. So the descending node would be a little bit to the east or left of the sun, so that this eclipse occurs at the descending node near the lunar apogee. So the moon would be near its smallest angular size, which is a clue that this could be an annular eclipse. So you may want to do this. If you have an astrology program, you probably don't, But you can tickle up your local astrologer. Just say, oh, you know, I'm thinking of taking a trip in December, like mid-December, near a new moon. Can you cut a horoscope? $75. All right, so you do that. And when you examine it, you find the sun and the moon close together, because it's new moon, but the node will be rather far away, either the ascending or the descending node, and it'll be too far away for the moon to actually intercept and cover the sun, even partly. So there is no eclipse of the sun in December because of the remoteness angularly of the node. So with that review of how eclipses occur and how you can demonstrate the behavior of the sun and the moon relative to the perigee, apogee, and the ascending, descending nodes, we now turn to the eclipse at hand, which takes place during the day hours, well, for be visible in the United States, and actually in other parts of the Americas, on October 14th. So in slide 13 shows the eclipse path, which begins out in the northern Pacific Ocean off the coast of Canada and Alaska, and you'll notice the little note near sunrise. That is, at that point, the shadow of the moon, or the anti-umbra, being an annual eclipse, touches the earth where the moon and sun are rising at that location. The path crosses into the U.S. and then down almost straight through Texas into the Gulf of Mexico. That occurs during the morning to around noon local time, with that daylight time scramble. And the eclipse keeps going, and it hits the north coast of South America, and it dives into northern Brazil, and then ends near sunset, as noted, in the mid-Atlantic Ocean. So those folk in South America see the eclipse at various times in their local afternoon. And that is a rather typical length in kilometers of an eclipse. The path width is not to scale. It's just a line drawn on the map. You will see also perpendicular to the path, both above and below, the north or south here, parallel lines with percent marks, which give the percent coverage for those off the center line. They will see a partial eclipse, and the little images of the sun show the maximum coverage for various distances away from the center line. So the center of Brazil, and then the Ecuador, Peru, Colombia regions, they'll see partial eclipses, and Peru and probably the southern Brazil will see a shallow partial eclipse. And on the north side, if you're in the center U.S. and the Gulf states, you have a deep partial. But in the American Northeast, like New York, you see a shallow partial. If you go into Quebec and beyond, you lose the eclipse altogether. The moon misses. Now that variation in coverage is due to the strong parallax of the moon. The moon is close enough to the Earth, so our line of sight to it does wander among the stars. Now, the pictures I showed earlier with the moon overlapping the sun, whatever, that is a geocentric condition, but it gives the concept that is the location of the observer is another order of influence on the aspect of the sun in the sky for a given eclipse. For a person in the center path looking into the sky, he'll see the scene in slide 14. A bare eye view with filtration would be in the lower left picture. The eclipse begins near the upper left. The photographer here took a time-lapse picture. And he also did the same, a different person did the same for the right-hand side. Look at that. The lower left, the eclipse begins at the upper left, which means the earlier hour. And as the sun traces across the sky, this is some previous annual eclipse which occurred in the afternoon from the photographer's location. And as the sun moves across the sky down to the lower right, because it is late afternoon, you'll notice that each image, the moon is biting a little more, a little more, a little more onto the disk of the sun. And finally, in the middle of the picture, we have about a central as you can get, and there's a thin ring of sun surrounding the moon. That's the mid-eclipse. And as the sun continues its diurnal motion, the moon moves off the sun and is mostly completely clear by the time the sun goes behind those trees and the house. You can take a picture like this. It gets a little tricky. You should kind of do this by yourself or with some other trusted friend who won't fiddle with the camera or knock the tripod or stand in front when you hit the shutter. So otherwise you spoil the whole effect. So you can do this and get a very good picture like that. The one on the upper right was taken in a similar way, but this was the digital images from a different photographer, where he picked selected images from the diurnal path and laid them out in roughly the same alignment, where the eclipse begins in the upper left corner and progresses to the lower right. The angular extent is very much compressed by picking maybe every fourth picture or something like that. And then you get in the middle the ring effect when the moon is sliding directly across the solar disk. Now, most eclipse pictures that show annular phases show a perfectly even width of ring because the person did station himself on the dead center of the eclipse path. Depending on your circumstances, you may be a little off. Like when I was in South Carolina for the 2017 total eclipse, the best that I could do was visit at my niece's house in Columbia, South Carolina, And her house was about 100 to 150 meters away from the dead center of the path. So I didn't see the last couple of milliseconds of totality when the moon starts coming off the sun. But that is how you get. So if you're off the center line, you get a ring effect, but the moon would be a little off center. So one side of the ring would be thin and the other one a little thicker. I wouldn't worry too much. It would be a great show when you come back to your hometown and you give your presentation to your club or science class. But that is kind of pictures you can take. Bear in mind that while you could do this photographically, you cannot look at the sun directly. You need the solar filtration, which is probably what the fellow for the right-hand picture did, which is why the sky is completely black. But that is what an annual eclipse will look like. The sky never gets dark. It gets somewhat like near actual sunset, or maybe during civil twilight. Oh, that's a drone. Yes, where's he going? Okay, so that is what you have for an annular eclipse. You don't get the cheering and hurrah and the noisemakers and horns for a total eclipse. Usually you get, you know, a clapping and then ooh and ah, look at that. But then the moon moves off and you get the partial phases like in the lower right of either picture. A sample timetable of the eclipse is in slide 15 for specimen places in the United States along the eclipse path, from Oregon at the top to Texas at the bottom. And they are sited in the local time, which is daylight time all over the United States. I think that, well, I don't know if there's one in Arizona. I don't happen to see it. Any case, these are daylight times, Pacific, Mountain, and Central time. The eclipse begins. That means that the moon just first touches and enters the disk of the sun. That is first contact. The next is the annularity begin, that is when the moon just fully is inside the solar disk and the ring is complete. That is, surprisingly, third contact, not second, third. Then you have maximum eclipse, which is when the center of the sun is as close as it gets to the center of the moon. The intercentral distance is a minimum, and that is when you have the fullest extent of the ring. Second contact is when the annular phase ends with the moon pushing off the sun and breaking the ring. And then the eclipse ends when the moon has fully left the solar disk, and that's the fourth contact. So this will give you an idea of when the eclipse will occur for locations where you might go to. I know that Albuquerque, New Mexico seems to be a favorite, at least among the people that I've spoken to. Maybe it just has more frequent air flights from other parts of the country, or it's a good stop on a sightseeing drive through the Southwest. any case, it's as good a point as any, and the weather prospects seem to be very favorable. But please do your own homework. Check with the eclipse tours what they say. Check with the local science museums, planetaria, astronomy clubs in the area where you're thinking of going to. Figure 16 shows the duration of the annular phase, that is the period of time that the moon is actually within the solar disk, four points along the path. They don't correspond exactly to the previous picture, but nevertheless, you get an idea of what's going on. And the durations are many minutes. In general, an annular eclipse lasts longer, on average, than a total eclipse. In fact, I was blessed, and a lot of others in the city area, to see in 1973 just about the longest possible solar eclipse. It was 6.5 minutes, the maximum being about 7 minutes, because the ship, the cruiser we were on, was not exactly, it drifted a little bit off center. We got a good 6.5 minutes of totality, which is close to the maximum. And then we also saw on a different trip on land just about the longest possible annular eclipse, which was about 12 minutes. And I'll be honest with you, although I love eclipses, after about 5 minutes, I was kind of bored silly. But I did tough it out. I watched the rest of it. And I was, you know, kind of happy that it was over. For those away from the center line, Figure 17 would be a good help. This is principally for the United States. For a variety of towns, including New York as a city, you get a picture showing the maximum coverage of the sun, which would be kind of on the southern side of the sun, and for New York would be quite one-third of the diameter covered, or in area, something like 28% coverage by area. And the distinction between what they call coverage percent is explained in that Eclipse Facts article from the AV Files homepage. Actually from the title page, which was linked to it. And you see dramatically that the farther from the center line you are, the less of the sun will be covered. So those in northern Quebec, Newfoundland, will get essentially nothing, whereas those, say, in northern Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, they will get a very deep partial eclipse. Now, in this year, 2023, solar activity is still very high. In fact, it equals, or in some cases exceeds, what we expected to come in 2025. Which means the solar cycle we're in now will either be already maximized now, or the maximum next year, 2025, will be even greater. But in any case, large sunspots are flecking the disk of the sun, and solar observers tell me that they're having a lot of fun watching these. And during any eclipse, whether you're on the center line or not, one interesting picture is shown, like in figure 18. The photographer here, most likely with a front-end filter on his telescope and upon focus at the eyepiece, he captured the partial eclipse of this particular instance near a large sunspot group near the center of the solar disk. Now, a picture like this, apart from being very pretty and emotional almost, has a tuition of value. So when I was new in astronomy, I learned about sunspots, and they were black markings on the surface of the sun, and drawings I've seen of them show a black dot, maybe some gray surrounding, that's the penumbra. Photographs, which were all black and white back in the old days, showed a black sunspots. Okay. But then, as I progressed into the profession, I learned about spectroheliographs, which would take a spectrum of the sun using a particular spectral line or band of wavelengths, and among the targets on the sun were sunspots. And among the information collected by a spectrum of the sunspot is its temperature, around 4500 K in temperature versus 6000 for the surrounding photosphere. But wait a minute. How can you get a spectrum of a black object with no light coming out of it? Well, actually, there's a hell of a lot of light coming from it. It's just a contrast effect. It looks dark because you're seeing it against a massively brighter surround. The 6,000 K area of the photosphere, a particular, like one square arc minute, will send out a lot more, many orders more radiation than the temperature inside the sunspot. A square arc minute there would emit a little, but still substantial. So there was an experiment I did when I used to run the observatory at my school. I took one eyepiece, it was a pretty junky eyepiece, so it didn't matter. It was a low enough magnification to get most of the solar disk in. And I put in there a diaphragm, so metal plate. Basically, I used a washer with a tiny pinhole in it. Well, not a pinhole, maybe 2 or 3 millimeters. Originally, it was for some kind of a long, narrow bolt. So I put that into the eyepiece. So when we look into it, the field is black, except for what can come in through that center aperture. So what I would do is, with the front end filter, aim the scope at the sun, and people would see the sun like this, without the moon, and would center it very carefully on the sunspot. They take that eyepiece out, put in the diaphragm eyepiece, and go look in there now. And what they see is a nice bright picture of a highly luminous piece of the sun with some vague structure that reminded them of the sunspots they just saw. And that's because they no longer had the overwhelming strength of the hotter surface and could see the light just from the cooler surface, which is still essentially hotter than just about any controlled temperature we can make on the Earth. I mean, I can't think of an industrial process that needs 4,500 Kelvin temperature. So that's a nice picture to take, no matter where you are and you're seeing the eclipse. There are 30 slides in this presentation, so we are moving along quite well. The next bunch of slides from 19 and on, 19 and on, show ways to safely look at the eclipse. And no matter where you are, even in the center path, you do need, for direct viewing, full protection. There is no point within that eclipse where you can take the filters off and look directly at the sky. So the simplest method, if you live near a science museum or a large planetarium, for sure they will have eclipse glasses, which are made by several accredited companies, and they'll either be given away or they charge you 10 cents for them or whatever, or they ask for a donation to the museum. These you can use, but please, when you have children around, like you see here, make sure that they're under your immediate supervision. That is, when they are looking toward the sun, just make sure they actually do fit the glasses on. Now, when the glasses are on, you will see nothing through the plastic sheet. It's a Mylar with a certified sun-safe coating. Don't you dare take an empty bag of chips and you see, ooh, here's a shiny section, cut that out, mount it in cardboard, and go look for it. You're doing the initiation to join the low vision club. This has happened, believe me. So use only certified sunglasses, like I say, from a reputable source that knows science and astronomy. Also, any of these devices that you acquire after the eclipse, keep them. Especially now, because next year in the United States is another eclipse. So within 6 months, you're going to be using them again. So please put them in a safe place so you know where you can find them, and include them in your kit when you go off for the 2024 eclipse. Other methods, but it's kind of hard to come by nowadays. What we used to do when we were into chemophotography, I went to the local photo finishing store and I bought a box of sheet film, the kind you put in those old-fashioned press photographer's camera. And I brought it home. Well, actually, I went outside and sit on the curb or fire hydrant, whatever. Opened the box and deliberately showed the sheets up to the sun. Now, I did it for all the sheets. They're all fully exposed to sunlight. And then I wrapped them all up again and went back into the store and said, hi, thank you very much. Now, I want these processed just for the negatives. Don't make prints. Mister, weren't you here about 5 minutes ago when you bought this film from us? Yes. I took all the pictures and these are ready to be processed. Are you sure? I didn't see you with any camera. No, don't you worry. Okay. So they did. And they gave me back an envelope with all these pictures in it. Said, oh, I'm sorry, mister, but something went wrong because these are all totally, totally black sheets. No, I have to charge you for the processing, but here, take this coupon. The next time you need photo work, this would be some credit for the next purchase. Oh, thank you. So then I went outside again, took one of the sheets, and I saw the sun, which was massively filtered, but not quite dark enough. I got a little anxiety. So I put two together. That's good, beautiful. So those were my sun filters, and it worked because it was purely metallic oxide silver, which absorbs uniformly over all wavelengths, and it's good for brief looks. You wouldn't stay there, say, for the entire partial phase doing this, but it would be good enough for just to keep it straight. You hold up, okay, all right, there's about 1/3 more to go, okay. And the same with these glasses. Just make sure, but you can't do it now because there's almost no place left that handles chemophotography. So the ones which I did way back when, I still kept them. Another source was a construction supply store which sold the glass shield for welders. And if you got a number 14, which is the densest, you can use that and look through the at the sun, because welding, I'm sure you've seen welding, even though they may be on the top of a tall skyscraper, when you get the sparks, they dazzle you. Well, like the poor guy who's sitting there reading distance away, he has to have something to cut down the glare. So he positions the rod and the torch, pulls down his mask with the shield and the filter, and then he does the weld. And he stops, pulls the torch away, checks the work, and so on. So that would be useful. But there are fewer and fewer of these walk-in stores where you can say, oh, mister, can I help you? Yeah, I need a number 14 glass. Okay. He climbs up in the ladder on the shelf, reaches into a box. Well, how many do you need? I'll take two. Okay. Come on down, wraps them up. Yeah, that's $5. Thank you. It's hard to do that nowadays. So the Mylar certified eclipse viewers is the way to go. Figure 20 shows another very common way among astronomers. Those who, the dealers of telescopes or accessories who have front end filters made of either glass or the specially coated Mylar in different diameters for various brands of telescope. And just to double check, you measure the diameter, the outer diameter of the tube, not the diameter of the lens inside, but the outer diameter of the tube to the nearest millimeter, and the dealer will select or make the filter in a frame or cell which will fit onto the front end of the telescope. And like this fellow here, he can look at the sun safely. As a safety enhancement, I would tape that on using masking tape to prevent if it being knocked off or blown off by wind. Again, when you look through it, you will see utterly nothing unless you are actually aimed at the sun. Which brings me to an interesting point. I have seen at eclipses a person say he has a telescope like this, fine. He has the filter on top. But now he's all at sea, literally if he's on a cruise ship. And how do I aim this at the sun? I look through the telescope, I see absolutely nothing, so I have no idea where I am relative to the sun. But there are some things, ways to do this, and if the finder scope is lined up properly, you can catch the glint of the sun on your hand or card shining through the finder, and you try to center that, and once you do that, you know, cover the finder, put the lens cap on, and then use the lowest power eyepiece or widest field of eyepiece, and slowly shift the scope to pick up the sun. In fact, you should use a low magnification because basically you're looking at the full disk of the sun. There's really nothing on a high power during a solar eclipse really except maybe the mountains on the edge of the moon, which is an interesting sight, but mainly low power wide field. Another trick is put a card or a white surface on the ground, and you move the telescope to make the shadow of its tube as perfectly circular and round as you can, not elongated or sideways. And again, the low power eyepiece with the filter in front, you should pick up the sun fairly easily. But that's one bit, the front end solar filter. And again, do not open up a snacks bag or the liner from the cereal packaging and tape that over your telescope. Again, you know, the Low Vision Club is going to have a hell of a lot of more applications after the eclipse. Okay, now we move on to projection methods. And slide 21 is a time-honored way of observing the sun when you have no filtration filters with you and you have to use the raw light coming into the telescope. What you do is you focus the telescope so you get a sharp image out the eyepiece onto a projection screen with a sheet of white cardboard, and you get the beautiful picture of the sun. And this can be looked at safely by a group of people. The only real hazard is the telescope has to be in attendance at all times to keep some person from innocently trying to just look directly through the eyepiece. And you can, or put a definite covering to show that the telescope is idle until you come back to look after it again. But this is a very safe way to do it. This is the way most of us did sunspot viewing with our first telescope. And this was in the era before the front-end filters were affordable. We had been at the college observatory for a 15 centimeter aperture, maybe it was 17 centimeter aperture, when it was purchased, I think a little before I came on board, like a $600 or $700, which is, but the modern ones that you can buy through any of the telescope dealers or accessory dealers will cost only a couple of tens of dollars. And once again, for that particular scope, you just put it away in a safe place for the next time you do solar viewing or the next time you see an eclipse. But that's a very convenient way. It's always to hand because all you need is an extra cardboard. A little danger, since you are focusing the full sunlight on that eyepiece, this is best for brief views. I would not track the sun with your clocktri continuously projecting. The inside of that eyepiece would be heated. The glue will melt, the rings and the flanges will warp, the lenses may crack. So do that for short views. And if you really are concerned, use an old eyepiece which you don't mind losing, or simply purchase from a dealer the cheapest eyepiece they sell that gives you a full disc of the sun, and then use that just for the solar projection. An interesting, but it really does work, device is the sun or solar viewing funnel shown in picture 22. On the right, you see a little bit about how it's constructed. You buy from a hardware store a large plastic opaque funnel. And It has to be plastic, because you're going to have to do some cutting and shaping using hobbyist or kitchen tools. A metal funnel won't do any good for you. And what you do is, at the neck, you cut the funnel where the neck is a bit, just about the diameter of the eyepiece and jaw tube that you would use on your scope. You just cut and throw away the excess. You then have to cut, you may have to use a jigsaw or hobby saw to do this, cut four slits so that the end of the funnel now has four prongs. You can separate the prongs a bit because it's a plastic funnel, so that they do slip onto and grip the eyepiece and the draw tube too. You would hold it in place either with the strong masking tape, or you can use a small pipe clamp like you use for repairing leaks in, say, water pipes. The upper end has across it, taped down securely, a sheet of wax paper, go find that, or tracing paper, a very thin paper that you can kind of see through to do a tracing. If you're an artist of any kind, you can use a piece of vellum or the white tissue that you sometimes wrap fruit in, or a gift box has sometimes a wrapping inside. You smooth it out very carefully. You flatten it out, make sure there's no wrinkles, and tape that to the upper end of the funnel. Then, using the aiming techniques I mentioned before, you get the sun on the funnel and you focus it like you would for projection method. You are projecting, except that you're doing what we call rear projection, which is often used for exhibits and certain kinds of theater, or movie theater. Some movie theaters have the projector in the back of the stage shining onto a thin translucent screen. Any case, and that actually does work. The plastic is light enough so it doesn't upset the balance of your telescope. The only thing to worry about is if it's very windy. The beauty of this method is there's no way that a innocent visitor will actually look directly into the eyepiece and do himself some nasty harm. The direct sunlight is fully enclosed, and on the left-hand side we see the view of the sun on that tracing paper covering at the upper end of the funnel. That left-hand picture also shows you do not need an elaborate instrument. That's a astroscan with the funnel attached to its eyepiece. And the little square to the left is the sticker that says, under no conditions must you aim this telescope at the sun. Well, this is a condition where you can, and don't forget the caution for both the pictures of overheating the eyepiece. So again, this would be for brief views of a couple of tens of seconds, and you can put the cap over the front end of the telescope for a while and send the visitors to do some other activity. 23 and 24 show two methods which are pushed by some news media and, sadly, astronomy media, using a pinhole projection. Now, pinhole projection does work, but you gotta do it right. In 23, we see two sheets of paper. It's actually labeled paper. One has a small hole, and the other is a white sheet to collect the pinhole image. Apart from the sheer flimsiness of paper, the projection screen is illuminated by the daylight surrounding it, and you probably won't even see the image. But in this case, from a website that purports to tell you how to view a solar eclipse, we notice that the sun is darker than the projection screen. And the explanation offered in the text is that during the eclipse, the sun turns dark. Well, find another website. This method doesn't work. 24 shows an elaboration where the author tells you to take a box. This one, a rather large one that you can put your head into. That's the hole at the bottom. And you put a small hole at one end and a white collection screen, a projection, at the other. The idea, and then you close the box, so there's a lid or a flap to close up the box. You put your head in it, and you fish around for the sun. Usually what you do is have a companion who kind of holds the box and guesstimates by peeking inside. Okay, you got the sun. And then he hands you the box and you watch it. You cannot walk around with this thing, and a group of these people with these stupid boxes on their head, hey, look at all the square heads, look at all the square heads. And again, from a website that really sincerely believes that the darkness of the sun during an eclipse will make a dark image on the screen. Of course, your head will get in the way because you'll always be moving it one way or the other, and you always, however still you stand, will nudge away from the sun. And you get nothing on it. You have to take the box off and try to recenter it and so on. And in any case, this doesn't work. The damnation of most of the pinhole methods is the minuscule size of the projected image. And even astronomy resources don't let you in on this. The diameter of the sun on the screen is 1/100, that's a rounded number, 1/100 the throw distance from the pinhole to the screen. So if you did the box technique in the last slide and you have a 400 millimeter length of box, your head is supposed to fit into that, or one side is open so you sort of lean into it, the image on the screen is 4 millimeters across. This is annoyingly small. Yet every diagram showing this projection method shows the image of the sun 2 centimeters or even more across. And so when you make this contraption and you do succeed in looking at the sun, you try this on the sun on days before the eclipse, and you go, what the hell did I do? Oh, what's that tiny little dot? It's round because the pinhole is round, right? Is that really a projected image? And you get frustrated and just put the box in the cardboard recycling pile. But the good way, and I really hope that you'll explore this for this eclipse and for next year, if you're in the partial zone, scout in your town or county for a large civic or public building which has a large lobby and with windows with a decorative or ornate border. There are many of these in New York City, and we actually used these in the 2017 eclipse. So the next slide, 25, shows one example from here in New York, where this building, there are several of these like this now, has windows with iron grill work around the edge. And on the right-hand side, okay, you see the sunlight shining onto the ground from that window. This is inside the building where you're comfortable, especially if you're doing this in the windy or cold weather. But look, there are also these magnificent round images, two of them here, and there's one in the back in the upper right. They are real McCoy pinhole images of the sun. And I know when I was working, I'm retired now, I would go to one of these buildings near my office, like during lunch, during a time when the sun would shine through the windows, with a sheet of cardboard, you know, white, and I would stand in the way of one of those dots and hold it perpendicular to the sunlight coming down on it, and I get a beautiful picture of the sun. I see the limb darkening, and if there are any sunspots, the larger ones, say the size of the Earth or larger, you know, you would see on the disk. And if a bypasser asked, hey buddy, what you looking at? The sun. There's no sun here, you gotta go outside. Oh no, 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 the sun's coming through the window and he's making a pinhole picture. But what was, oh, your cardboard is dirty, it has those dots on it. No, 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 here, I'll show you. So I moved to the adjacent spot, and this spot, little dots on the sun are in the same place. The guy walks away thinking that he saw something totally miraculous. Now the reason I said use a building with a large, maybe a tall ceiling room, is to get a throw distance. Those spots there are 15 to 20 centimeters across, meaning that the throw distance from the window to the ground is 15 to 20 meters. Hence, what you should do is scout around in your town for such buildings and then do a sanity check that the sun will shine through their windows during the hours of the eclipse. I mean, you may find that the windows are on the wrong side, on the north side of the building, in which case the sun doesn't get to them. But you have to actually test them. And it should be a public building, not one where you have to grovel on the ground and ask permission to come in. So a library, a museum, a post office, trying to think of a courthouse, and that kind of a structure where you can freely walk in, as long as you don't make any mess and trouble, that they leave you alone. And have your cardboard. Do this in a pair, two of you. One holds the cardboard, the other takes pictures of the eclipse on the cardboard, maybe a little distant picture showing you holding the cardboard, a picture of the window so you can show how the image was formed. And we did this in 2017. The sun, by good chance, shined through these ornate windows on several of these civic buildings in New York, and many of us went there. I was in South Carolina, but others who stayed in the city did that, and they said it's really, really a fun thing to do. And they're going to be checking for the sun exposure for this October eclipse and the 2024 eclipse, again, if they stay in town. But please do that, and of course, do it now. Don't wait till the morning of the eclipse and say, gee, we're going to go see this inside. No, do this, you know, over the next couple of weeks. And with your planetarium program, get the hours of sunshine into that building's windows. Some of us like to do our own plotting of the eclipse path, especially in the vicinity where we are observing the eclipse. So you could pull down from the eclipse page from the NASA website the fact sheet for the eclipse. And slides 26 and 27 show you the upper and lower half of that sheet. Again, I reversed the color for a easier reading on most computer screens, especially the small ones. The parameters on the corners of the sheet, the upper and lower halves, give you the raw material for you to do your own path plotting. You do need some familiarity with math and graphics and having a set of drawing tools is pretty much necessary, and of course a SciTech calculate. But if you're into it, these two pictures give you the basic facts and figures and parameters to roll your own eclipse path. Now, although eclipses occur pretty frequently, you essentially have to have two solar eclipses per year, so there has to be at least 200 per century. But it works out that you typically can get maybe three solar eclipses in a year, and therefore about 300 per century. But the path width is so narrow that the chances of an arbitrary location, like your home, having the eclipse path over you is rather slim, so roughly once in 200 years or so. But if you're willing to accept partial eclipses, slide 28 will give you some encouragement. It gives those eclipses 2000-2040, which were visible or will be visible in New York. Now, for the past eclipses, some were wiped out by cloud, but otherwise, many of these, if you're in the city area, will remember these. Oh, I remember. Oh, yeah, that eclipse in 2000, right, at the beginning of the century. Yeah, I remember seeing that one. That was on Christmas Day. And of course, some of you will be looking forward to this one in 2023, next year, 2024, and then several more through 2040. Hence, if you never saw a solar eclipse, you really don't have to travel as long as you're content with partials. Having said that, in the last couple of columns, one of them is the percent coverage or the extent, and some of them are pretty small. Like the one next year, it'd be about 90%, and the one coming in a few weeks is about 33%, or one-third. But some are grazes where the 1% of the sun is covered, and although technically speaking, it is an eclipse over your home, most would just pass it up. And that is somehow any eclipse, rather than just the central path of an eclipse, can come over your house, you know, every couple of years. details for a timetable for the eclipse for New York came from a feminist program in slide 29. The times of the phase of the eclipse are in Eastern Standard Time. Most astronomy programs don't care about daylight, especially since, at least in the United States, it's very arbitrarily set by a congressional law, which can be changed literally at any time. So those are Eastern Standard Time, and at least for 2023, you add 1 hour to get the daylight time, which will still be enforced during October. Eclipse begins, that's first contact, when the moon first nicks the edge of the sun on the western, celestial western limb. Maximum eclipse is when the greatest diameter is covered by the moon, or when the center of the sun and the center of the moon are closest. And the eclipse ends at fourth contact, when the last bit of sun is free from the moon. Notice that because the moon never sits within the disk of the sun, we do not have second or third contact. The ephemeris also produces the altitude of the sun, which will help you plan for landscape obstructions. And then the last two columns are the points around the edge of the sun, counterclockwise from celestial north, if you're viewing with a equatorially or polar mounted telescope, or counterclockwise from straight up, the 12 o'clock position, if you're using an azimuth scope or binoculars or bare eye. That will help you anticipate how to frame your pictures. The stuff at the bottom you can ignore because it's just a little fiddly to go into any detail, but you do got there the magnitude, which more or less corresponds to the diameter of the sun that's actually covered, and the obscuration, which means the percent of area covered. So about 25% of the area, or 28% of the area of the sun is covered, and around one-third of the diameter. Our last slide, number 30, gives what you can look forward to next year. I mean, if you really got fired up watching this present eclipse, or you are whacked out by clouds, you have next April, the big total eclipse, the slices from Mexico through Texas, Mississippi, Missouri area, and the southern Great Lakes into the St. Lawrence. And there are many towns noted along it within the central path by which you can anticipate where to travel to. For those of us in New York area, Buffalo might be a prime choice. Okay, so that concludes the session on the October 14th eclipse. And now it is time for your quiz. Go back to slide 7 that showed upper half a total eclipse, and then the lower half an annular eclipse. Now, although the ratio in size moon to Earth is about correct, a little more than a quarter the diameter of the Earth being that for the moon, the distance scale is totally ridiculously compressed. In fact, essentially all diagrams, even those from very reputable and authoritative sources, give the most insanely absurd, out-of-scale eclipse pictures. Diagrams showing the umbra and the penumbra. And there's a reason for that, and you're going to show why if you answer the quiz. First, take for the total eclipse. The shadow cone just reaches the Earth. So a line from the upper side of the moon down to the Earth, and from the lower side of the moon to the Earth, meet substantially at a point. And that angle between the two sides of the moon would be the angular size of the moon as it would appear in the sky if that diagram were for true scale as far as distance. So the first part of your quiz is, allowing that the diagram is correct, how big in the local sky, your sky, would the moon appear? And you can make it a little more dramatic by taking a night sky scene from your planetarium and superimposing on, using computer image editing, a picture of the moon, which you scale for the angular diameter that you work out, and plop it somewhere along the ecliptic, and that would give you a very dramatic illustration about how ludicrously wrong these diagrams are. Okay, the second half is using the diameter of the moon and the Earth as measured on your viewing screen, and then knowing that the moon actually is quite 1/2 degree. So here you use your pocket calculator, and the diameters that you measured, how far from the Earth, for a correctly scaled diagram, would the moon have to be? For instance, if you measure on your screen that the moon is 27 millimeters and the Earth is around 100 millimeters because you zoomed in a bit, then how far away in millimeters or whatever, or in diameters of the Earth would the moon have to be? And it may surprise you just how far the moon has to be. And it will even amaze you that the Greek astronomers, 25 or so hundred years ago, worked this out. Okay? So, until next time, pray for clear skies.